Hello, this is Luke Hunt, and welcome to the Diplomat podcast program. With me is the Australian playwright Ross Mueller, alongside the actor and social commentator Rhys Muldoon. Mueller is responsible for the play I Can't Even, a political satire produced at the Malthouse Theatre, one of Melbourne's premier playhouses. It evolves around a speech to be delivered by the Prime Minister of Australia, played by Muldoon, and is winning praise for its encapsulation of political life in this country over the last decade, and in particular, the leadership turmoil which engulfed previous Prime Ministers Kevin Rudd, Julia Gillard, and Tony Abbott. It also touches on Australia's relationship with Asia and its closest ally, the United States. I started by asking Mueller how the play came about.
Let's see, about 8 months ago, maybe 12 months ago, I was meeting with Matt Lutton, who's the artistic director of Malthouse Theatre, and we were talking about the state of politics in Australia and the problems that we were facing, and Tony Abbott was in office, so it was probably even longer than 12 months now. And he said, you know, you should write a speech. You should write a speech that everybody wants to hear, because Tony was delivering a lot of policies that he hadn't promised. You know, there's a lot of surprises that were happening, and a lot of people were really disillusioned with him as a prime minister.
There was also a lot of controversy. I mean, particularly Stop the Boats, and that seemed to dominate everything when you looked at Australian politics from afar. What were the major policies that were coming through at that point?
Yeah, well, that negativity of Stop the Boats and dividing and conquering was the thing that was driving every policy setting of the government at the time. And it was about a three-word slogan, and it was about creating an atmosphere of fear and loathing of other that really drove us to the point of saying, well, you know, there's got to be another message. There's got to be another story to tell. And so Matt said, you know, you should write this speech, and when there's an election, we'll program the play, you know, and we'll just put it up and do it as quickly as possible. Unbeknownst to us, there was a plot in the background, and Tony's prime ministership came to an abrupt end in 2015 when Malcolm Turnbull took over in a coup. And he was a very popular prime minister. And so we panicked because there was no show for us, because Malcolm was 75% popularity rate in the polls. And we said, well, you know, there's nothing to write about now. And, of course, within 2 or 3 weeks, Australia realised that Malcolm was just a friendlier version of Tony. And so the show is equally as, you know, targeted and bitey now as it was back then.
Okay. And, Rhys, how do you interpret Ross Mueller? How do you perceive the script?
Well, it's funny that I'm working on this script, because I was actually asked at one point and did it. I wrote a speech, the speech that Tony Abbott should have given at the G20, because he very much humiliated himself, you know, talking to Obama about $7 co-payments to doctors and really the minutiae of Australian politics, when really at G20 you should be talking about bigger issues. You know, he was talking about very minor, small target Australian local issues.
As opposed to climate change and these sorts of things.
Climate change is exactly what he didn't want to talk about. That's why he was bringing up minor matters. And so as Ross says, this is the speech that's sort of been written by committee in some ways for whoever happens to be the Prime Minister at the time. And it even says, insert name of current Prime Minister within the text, which Malcolm Turnbull actually reads out and is not particularly happy with, because we're now the sort of coup capital of the world. We've had, whatever it is, 6 Prime Ministers in however many years, you know, it's... so it's sort of tackling that. And it's basically, it's tackling sort of Malcolm Turnbull trying to... squeeze, you know, it's trying to squeeze a square peg into a round hole, basically, which is Malcolm Turnbull's actual beliefs versus the party's beliefs. And he's very much beholden to the right wing of the party, and he's got to adjust accordingly, and it's not a particularly comfortable fit.
How does that stack up against the Labor Party and the left wing of Australian politics, where it stands today, particularly given, as you mentioned, there were the coups, and that includes Labor Party with Kevin Rudd and Julia Gillard as well?
Well, I mean, I think what happened there was, with the, particularly with the Labor Party self-destructing in the way that they did, what they did was they threw out the natural rhythm of how politics should have gone in this country, in that it should, you know, you would have expected it would have gone something like Rudd, Rudd, Gillard or Turnbull, then maybe Turnbull again, then maybe Gillard, you know, like it should have sort of gone like that. And it, but it suddenly threw it all up in the air. And it's been chaotic for both sides. So Labor Party self-destructed, and then the Liberal Party weren't ready to govern. They just didn't have the talent, and they still don't, in my opinion. You know, they didn't, not enough fresh blood in that party to actually run a country successfully. So in a lot of ways, you know, the Labor Party have to be held to account for a lot of this, in because they blew up the regular symphony that was, that is Australian politics, the basic rhythm of kind of two terms for you, one or two terms for us, two terms for you, one or two terms for us, et cetera, et cetera. It suddenly became term, half term, quarter term, third, you know what I mean, all over the shop. So the Labor Party, they've got to find their values. They're seeming to find them more so now that Turnbull's Liberal Party are floundering. So they're sort of starting to find points of difference.
Right. There's Bill Shorten, who could well be the next Prime Minister of Australia if he wins at the election. He was actually in there with the gutting of Kevin Rudd and putting Gillard in place. And I think there's still a bad aura around Bill Shorten for that reason, and that the Australian public don't seem to trust him almost as they don't seem to trust the Liberal Party as well.
Well, yeah, I think that's true. I think there's a number of front benches in the Labor Party who were active in those times, and Reece knows better than anybody because he was there in the midst of all of it was going down. But like people like Richard Marles, who's the Shadow Minister for Immigration, was knee-deep in the numbers that was being put together to displace Julia or displace Kevin. And yeah, look, the way that the Labor Party has reinvented itself over the last 3 years has been interesting, because, you know, normally in an opposition, you would expect to see disunity. You would expect to see different people pushing different agendas. And they've spent the last 3 years preparing for government rather than resigning themselves to the idea that they'll never be elected for another 10 years. So despite the fact that there's been that kind of backroom deals and, you know, people with blood on their hands, they've been remarkably solid. There hasn't been the disunity that you might have expected in other times. What do you think?
Well, and I think also they take some hope in Queensland politics, which saw a Liberal government flicked out in one term, like incredibly quickly. Campbell Newman sort of came and went, just like, you know, Campbell Newman who, suddenly. And so I think the Labor Party took a lot of... because Queensland politics is very volatile at the best of times, but I think the Labor Party took a lot of stock from that and got a lot of confidence out of it. But going back to Bill Shorten for a moment, yes, I think, you know, that Bill Shorten is one of the most Machiavellian figures in this entire sort of melodrama, in that he overleaped two prime ministers, you know, like as in he jumped a kind of a generation to become leader of the Labor Party. I think the natural trajectory was going to be, because I think Gillard, I think like two prime ministers were killed with that coup, in that I think Rudd was, you know, firstly wasted and Gillard was wasted because I don't think she was ready to govern. I think if it had gone Rudd, Rudd, then Gillard would be ready to govern. You know what I mean? You could have had two solid Labor prime ministers, but they basically torched two of them. And it takes a lot to get to the top and all that sort of stuff. Bill Shorten finds himself, he's overleaped both of them. And so that that issue of trust still hangs high. I think it's disappearing a little bit more. It's not as at the forefront as it was, but I think it still lingers.
I noticed also that during rehearsals for the play that you touched on Asia, with the upcoming elections and with both political parties... all three of us are old enough to have heard all the stories about Australia's engagement with Asia over the last 20, 30 years, from Pauline Hanson and John Howard all the way through, Bob Hawke even. Paul Keating, right, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, that's right. How do you see the impact, not necessarily the impact of this election on Asia, but perhaps the impact of this election, which could have on Australia's relationship with Asia?
Yeah, the way I see it at the moment, it's pretty static. And I feel, you know, we talked about Paul Keating introducing the concept of Australia being part of an Asian century. And that was, he lost that election. you know, and that I was there at the that arts launch when he you were there too, yeah, and he, that was an amazing time. It was an amazing speech that he gave, because it was almost the speech that he could give in complete freedom, because he knew he wasn't going to win. And so these truths were resonating around the theatre that day. And we've never had a leadership since that time that has embraced the concept of, well, who are our neighbours and how can we behave more like we're part of a region rather than we're some kind of colonial outpost. And I can't see that changing with the current leadership in either party.
It was such a shock to hear that it's firstly that it's the Asian century, that America is no longer the great superpower. And I think hearing that Australia is part of Asia really shocks a core part of the way Australia sees itself. Going all the way back, obviously, to the gold diggers and the riots against Asians and the Asian invasion, and the Labor Party was so much built on fear of Asia. And I think that's really deeply embedded within the Australian psyche, and that Australia is separate. You know, that it's that we're connected to the West. We're not connected to the East. It's quite a shock. And I mean, and even hearing that that China bought Darwin's port. That's a shock. I mean, you know, the Americans got a bit of a shock with that one too. I'm pretty sure most of the nation did. I mean, how did that happen? I mean, suddenly it was just sold to China. Did anyone get asked about that? But I think Australia, in one way that we've matured as far as our relationship with Asia per se, is that Asian migration is no longer the most recent migrant, because whoever the most recent migrant is the one who gets their head kicked the most. You know, so like it used to be the Greeks and the Italians, then it becomes the Vietnamese for a while, now it's the Africans or whoever it is.
Normally it's the most recent arrivals that do the head kicking. The previous generations really don't care. They know, they realise what this country's built on. But it's always been interesting to see the Greeks and the Italians complain about the Vietnamese and the Cambodians, who then complain about the Somalis, who then complain about the Afghans and the Iraqis. It has a life of its own.
Absolutely, because you know, you can totally understand the thinking, because you go, whoever the most recent migrant is, take all the crap jobs that nobody wants to be able to get their next generation into a university or into a better job. And so then the next people that are coming up, you know what I mean? They're like, you don't have it easy. You know, we had to do it really hard and work in fish and chip shops and do all the stuff that nobody wanted to do. And now you're trying, you know, you want to just sort of get the easy ride. You don't, yeah, you're absolutely right. I think in that way, Asians are just absolutely kind of just part of the community now. You don't sort of go like, oh, look at all those Asians. You know, you used to hear a lot more about Asians during the Pauline Hanson years, and as if there was this some sort of invasion going on. And now I think Australia is a little bit more mature and is now seeing the opportunities economically. But also, like, I think that there's a fear because China is so massive and has so much money, and, you know, the Americans owe them so much money.
On that point, I think it's also worth noting that much of Asia also have very similar fears, because they see China as this extraordinarily enormous neighbour, which, when you compare it with Australia's size, it's we're quite big in terms of area. And when you look at these very tiny countries that just hang off the bottom of China, the fears and the xenophobia in these countries is quite extreme and actually makes Australia look very well-rounded. You know, Ross...
Yeah, and the xenophobia was the thing that got Tony Abbott elected. And we shouldn't forget that. Like, you know, when we hear this, I hear our thoughts now, and we're sort of speaking with optimism, because I think the worst of Australia is behind us, you know.
Here's hoping. Yeah, well, here's hoping. Yeah, no. But Abbott still from the back bench is, still saying that... And if you noted, Bronwyn Bishop said, I want to stick around and... on defence, you know, because that's the perceived strength of the Liberal National Party as opposed to Labor is defence. So it's to pump up the terror threat.
That's right. And one of the points of development in this play was when, you know, it was confirmed that the play was going to happen, and the first person I spoke to was Reese, and to say, you know, we're going to do this, and do you want to be part of it? And on that very day, there was a border force.
Debacle.
We were sitting having a coffee, and in the background down at Flinders Street Station, you know, Peter Dutton had activated this thing called Border Force that nobody really knew about.
Operation Fortitude, it was
That's
called.
Right.
Can you take us back? And I do remember this, and it made headlines in Australia. And if I remember right, it was one of those stories that lived for about 2 minutes but managed to shock the pants off everyone.
Basically, what happened was the story got out that Border Force, which used to be just known as Customs, and they changed the name to Border Force to make it sound really aggro and reinvented their uniforms, made them look more sort of fascistic and, you know, and more aggressive and all that sort of stuff, and got given a whole lot more money. Basically, out went the directive to start checking passports on the streets of Melbourne. Now, not only is that ridiculous, talk about choosing the wrong city. I mean, there is no more politically engaged city than Melbourne. So word got out instantly, and there were just protests within seconds, and the whole thing was just an embarrassing debacle from the moment it started.
And there was a post that there was a series of, you know, cover ups to say, oh no, that was a mistake. That email shouldn't have been sent, or I didn't send that email, or I never wanted anybody to check anybody's passports. But there was that threat of this is the potential of what an Australian future could look like. And I think Rhys is right to say, you know, the biggest mistake they made that day was to do it in Melbourne rather than in, you know, Adelaide or
Sydney.
Sydney was somewhere that you know, people wouldn't say it's time to draw a line in the sand.
Yeah, I was quite shocked, having grown up in Melbourne and lived in Sydney for 5 years. I was back there a few years ago, and I was absolutely surprised walking through King's Cross. 5 o'clock on a Friday afternoon, cops arrive in orange uniforms with dogs, big Alsatians, and they're walking them up and down the strip, letting the dogs freely sniff people for drugs. I understand the police have a job to do, and I understand there's a lot of nasty characters out there, particularly in the Cross, but when German shepherds are freely allowed to wander up and sniff people, I just thought, this is not the city I want to live in. But more, and also, it's not the city, certainly not Melbourne, if you know what I mean.
Well, try going to a rock concert these days. I mean, if you go to a music festival, there will be sniffer dogs, there will be police. And there will be, and people have OD'd because of that, because, you know, they'll have all their, you know, their pills that they might be sharing with their friends in their mouth. Suddenly the police get them, they swallow all the pills, and suddenly they're off to hospital, you know, because, yeah, but that's, you know, yeah, the side of dogs and police is never a pretty sight.
It's almost a metaphor for Thatcher's Britain that is a constant.
Like the miners' strike. Yeah, like the miners' strike. Just that aggressive, here's the line. You know what I mean? Like, do not cross this line.
So I guess the question, and bringing it back to your play, Ross, is that it's a very right-wing world that I think we live in, even if people are still voting left. And I think this is a theme that's constantly coming out in your play, and it's a struggle between the right-wing way of doing things and the left, which I think would like to cast itself as more socially minded.
Yeah, that's true. And in the Australian Labor Party National Conference last year, the Labor Party decided to maintain the border protection policy. So they share a similar, almost word-for-word policy as the right-wing Liberal Party.
And they also have similar policies in regards to Nauru and Manus Islands and the turning back of the boats.
Precisely. And so from a voter's perspective, while there is no difference between those two policies, we talk about our relationship with Asia, you know, that's a myopic understanding of what we as a country could or should be behaving in the area.
Yeah, and also, I mean, I think it's important to remember, you know, that our closest neighbour, basically Indonesia, which is 250 million Muslims right above us, and the Liberal National Party government have not done much to help those relations. I mean, Paul Keating was very strong and, you know, on engaging. You've got to engage with Indonesia. Like, I mean, there are all sorts of opportunities, you know, let alone it just makes common sense to be friends with your neighbour.
On that note, Southeast Asia, ASEAN, that's 10 countries. East Asia, you can put in China, Japan, North Korea, South Korea. When one reads the newspapers here and listens to the news bulletins and the commentary, one could be forgiven for thinking that only China exists in Asia. Is there too much of an emphasis on China? And it's a very different country as opposed to the other countries within the region.
I think so, yeah. I think Australia is like one big cooking show. And, you know, or we talk about the Asian influence. Yeah. We're talking about, I'm cooking a curry with an Asian influence. You know, we don't drill down into which country in Asia we're talking about. We don't understand the individual spices, you know. And it's driven by an economic understanding of the rest of the world. And China is the biggest investor. When Australians think about Asia, they think about China. But they don't see the difference.
I think a moment of honesty... Tony Abbott was speaking with the German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who asked him, what is Australia's policy of engagement with China? What drives Australia's relationship with China? To which Tony Abbott replied, fear and greed. And I think it was coming from Abbott, it was quite refreshing.
I mean, it's the same as Wall Street, really, isn't it? I mean, just sees it as a giant Wall Street.
Yeah, it's just fear and greed.
Ross, what are your plans for this show?
Well, we're doing the show for 4 nights only. The idea it was supposed to be a reaction rather than a season. And I think it's going to be a successful sort of dot point in the map of the election rather than trying to pretend that it's going for an extended life beyond that period.
Reese?
You know, having rehearsed it, I think it's going to really work. One of the main themes is that struggle of the individual's beliefs within a party and trying, you know, and democracy and try, you know, how do you get what you sincerely believe through the party machine and get a result? How do you do that? How do you manage it? And how do you, because what you're seeing at the moment is you're seeing Turnbull getting pushed around by backbenchers in his own party, the right wing, including Tony Abbott. And it's like a minority, and they're basically running the show. And it's like, how does he stamp his authority on his new prime ministership? That's the big question for me.
And Ross, this play is obviously going to cement you as a political commentator at a national level. Where do you see yourself going next?
I think, for me, it's been really exciting to have a theatre company in Australia that's prepared to work with political work again and to do something that's contemporary and responsive. That seemed to be happening more in the late 1980s and 1990s. And culturally, I think Australia's gone through a real misstep, a point where we've gone back to more traditional ways of making art. And when I've been to Thailand and seen, you know, the way that art is made on the street as quickly as possible and put into whatever gallery space can be found rather than having to have it curated. When I come back to Australia, I think, well, you know, what have we missed? And I think we've missed the urgency of being able to tell our stories quickly. And this show has been great like that. It's been great to create a relationship with Malthouse Theatre. And hopefully we can continue to make more exciting dialogues with an audience beyond this space and into the future.
That was where I left my conversation with Ross Mueller and Reese Muldoon. The next stop was opening night, and judging by the packed audience and the applause for I Can't Even, the play was a terrific success. I'm Luke Hunt, and this has been a podcast for The Diplomat.
We also have a round of applause for Ross Mueller, if he can stand up, our playwright. Ross. Peter up in the box. And Matt, our guest. Thank you very much for that.